Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
All of our complaints from book one have improved into book two.
Yes. There's nothing bad about this book. It's all incredibly well done.
Every tidbit now that you're experiencing, I'm trusting him more that it will pay off. The way he writes is unique, too. This one seems that he knew he was writing a book and not a screenplay. Welcome back to another Tudor Ramble episode. I am one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
We are reviewing Dead House Gates, book two of Malazan, The Fall of an Empire. What is that, the second part of it? Malazan something something of an empire.
Whatever. Doesn't matter. Malazan. We're here for Malazan. It's all that matters.
We've reviewed book one on this channel kind of long ago, and Salty came on for that review. Thank you again, Salty. And the reason he came on that review is because we were not fans of book one.
Yeah, that it did not connect with us. It was too weird, even for us. I would say not just the weird aspect of it, I think fundamentally flawed. But anyway, we read on. I read on a little earlier than Austin. Patreon members convinced me, including Salty. And yeah, I really loved book two, and I was excited to push Austin to read it as well.
So before we spoil anything, this is all spoiler free for book two, but also even before we spoil book one at all, for those people that are just tuning in and saying, oh, this is book two of Malazan, book one, which we talked negatively about, why would people want to get into the Malazan binge? And yeah, people do love book one more than us. So yeah, what is the series? What is the pitch? This is written by Steven Erickson. How would you pitch it to somebody of why they should start the series?
If you're kind of tired of basic fantasy stuff where maybe you feel like you're being taken by the hand through world building, characters, and plot points where it's all just, you think you've seen it all before, Malazan is a great antidote to that. You're thrown right into the deep end. The author does not hold your hand on anything. And on top of that, Erickson is a really funny guy. He has some really witty characters. It's very funny. I think it is a crazy series from the get-go. And if you connect with the characters, unlike us, you'll probably love it. If you love the mystery of the world building and just so many things that you have no idea what's going on, but you know it's relevant and you'll find out later.
It's epic in the largest term you can use, fantasy. And book one, the reason we didn't connect with it was, since the book doesn't hold your hand at all, we didn't know what to care about. Some of the world things and plots that were happening, a lot of people call it confusing. I think you and I agree. It's sure more confusing than other things, as in it's complex, but the plot makes sense. You can follow it.
Yeah.
You can comprehend it way significantly more so than what we'd recently read, The Shadow of the Torturer, Gene Wolfe's series, Book of the New Sun. But so you can understand it. But the thing that Rich and I felt was we didn't know what to care about. Things just happened. And the reason we like book two so much more is if you were off put by book one and you felt the same as Rich and I, book two, Dead House Gates, has a much more, you know what to care about. You know what the stakes are. It's self-contained. It does. All of our complaints from book one have improved into book two.
Yes. The bigger part for me with book one, there are a lot of world building elements that were just thrown at you. And because it's book one and we have no context, it can seem very random, nonsensical. And you go, well, I don't know the rules or boundaries of this world, so just anything could happen. And it really takes a lot of the stakes out of the story for me. But in book two, the world building elements are threaded in and brought up slowly, where from the very beginning, we're teased about certain elements. We're asking questions, what's going on? And the world building is explored through the characters that we are following. in a very organic way where I'm connected to the characters and I'm connected to this discovery of the world.
Yeah.
It's exactly how it should be done. It's everything I wanted from book one, and now it's in book two, and I love it.
Steven Erikson goes, hey, this is what's important. Pay attention to... That's probably horrible on audio. Sorry, Nick. Or whatever. But he beats you on the head going, this is the thing to pay attention to. I'm like, oh, okay. Makes sense. And a part of this, I was looking at this and fact check me if I'm wrong, but I didn't see where Steven Erikson said this. I saw the fandom say this. So I didn't find the original source, but the fandom says that book one was written 10 years prior to book two and the rest of the series, where he wrote Gardens of the Moon, and I believe it was supposed to be a screenplay at first. And a lot of it reads as if it was a screenplay, switching between point of views. I think there's 33, 40 something character point of views in book one. Book two, there's 23, something like that.
There's a lot,
but it's condensed. The ones it's focused on, you can tell there's four or five main protagonists in this one. So onto that is, this one seems that he knew he was writing a book and not a screenplay. And I'm saying that in the terms that this book definitely reads more like a book.
Yeah.
Even though the other one's a book.
Man, that's a low bar, but hey, he exceeded it handsomely.
I realize that seems like I am
a backhanded compliment. Yeah.
Backhanded compliment. Just, do you agree or disagree with that? The first one's felt like a screenplay.
Yes.
Okay. You do.
I do.
Okay.
Quick pause from this video to thank our sponsor, Into the AM. It's a men's apparel company. We're wearing some of their shirts. It's super soft.
They're very soft.
They look super cool. Let me give a better view of that. Move the mic.
Yes.
Look at that. Got some Cali color vibes.
They have apparel. They have jackets, t-shirts. Go onto their site, Into the AM. You could check out all their designs, which are hand-selected and crafted by their artists here. And they have sci-fi, nature-esque ones that fit our vibe very well. I personally love the whole wizard getup that I've got. But Into the AM, they specifically for men's apparel, if anybody wants to check them out, highly recommend. 10% discount going to intotheam.com/ramble, which you can look at the top of our description below, to get designs like this to rock them. And personally, I think if more people get the wizard design, they're cooler overall as a person.
I'll say, I think I see some weed on that. I think that guy is an apothecary.
No, sorts. No. He's a wizard.
Mm-hmm.
He's 100%. Is there?
Oh, no. I like my Cali shirt vibe.
Oh, talking weed. Yeah, like California doesn't have. Yeah, okay.
But, go check them out in the description down below. They're actually really super soft, yes, High quality t-shirts. And let them know we sent you there.
Thanks, Into the AM.
Right back to the episode.
So before, now, we're not going to spoil book two, Dead House Gates, quite yet. Here's our spoiler-free thoughts. Let's catch people up. So if they read book one, where did book one end before we get into Dead House Gates?
Okay. So the end of book one, which this has been a while. Let's see how good
he's a noggin. Yeah.
Let's see how good the old sieve is. There's a lot of things to predict. Okay. Basically, the Bridge Burners, I think, is one of the main groups and a lot. Let's start with them. Bridge Burners are excised from the Empire, the Malazan Empire. They're kind of on the run and on the hunt to actually kill the Empress of the Malazan Empire. And a handful of them are on a mission. They're taking our newly discovered or newly reborn assassin gal who was controlled by one of the gods, now no longer
Absalar.
Yeah. They're taking her home with also the intention of, we're gonna go kill the Empress as well. So you got that, and a group of them are doing that. Then you also have the sister of Paran. She is what do you want?
Oh, no, that's important to say, because book one, Gardens of the Moon, that's the only plot point and characters that we follow into book two, right?
Then there we go. That's enough.
That's
all right, fine.
No, just...
We'll stop there.
No, just with Gardens of the Moon, it's interesting because book two takes place on a different continent.
Yeah.
Completely. So book one, where it ended, was you have Absalar, who was the god Absalar. It has a lot of names. God. of many things. And our company with Crocus, if you remember Crocus from book one, but all these characters that we are now following. So only one point of view shift in this book follows from Gardens of the Moon, whereas all, we don't see and we don't continue with a lot of the other characters. A lot of the bridge burners we don't see.
We get little hints of, mm-hmm. you know, they appear a little bit or through communication, but
yeah.
we don't actually get to see them.
Yes, exactly. And then setting up this one for Gardens of the Moon, Deadhouse Gates, setting up Deadhouse Gates, spoiler free, then going into that part of those other characters were getting introduced to Fleecen and you were getting into those folks. So we had Fleecen and Co.
Yep, we have Fleecen and her group, which yeah. is the sister of Perron, who is from the first book. Mm-hmm. And we get to see her journey and her relevance to this story. I'm trying to keep it spoiler free.
Yeah.
And then we also get Icarium and Mappo, which is your greater world builders yeah. for it. We do get to see some of their kind in the first book, and they're mentioned. This, we actually get the actual characters and get a lot more time with them. Mm-hmm. And then we have the Chain of Dogs. It's fine. We'll talk about it later. It doesn't need to be in the spoiler-free section. We'll get to it. We got some other stuff in there, but yeah. I think that's good enough.
That is. The setup for this book, I'll read it right from a tiny little blurb. It says, in the vast dominion of the seven cities, in the holy desert Raraku, the seer Shaik gathers an army around her in preparation for the long prophesied uprising named the Whirlwind. Unprecedented in its size and savagery, it will embroil the Malazan Empire in one of the bloodiest conflicts it has ever known. A maelstrom of fanaticism and bloodlust that will shape destinies and give birth to legends. Already you can see the focus of book two. It's about this rebellion. And you are starting this book with our point of view characters that we already got in book one from Gardens of the Moon was Crocus, Fiddler, Apsilar, that group. But then you're introduced to all those new people you're talking about, Mappo and the Trells and Jogs. And the world still doesn't hold your hand. It's just more focused, but it works so much better. And to say other people's thoughts, Salty, who is the whole reason we're reading this series, and nobody else on the patron side.
No one else. He's our resident Malazan expert.
He is the expert. And thinks very highly of this. We have a cohort of people on the Patreon that this is their favorite thing ever. And so they were very happy to hear that, book two did it better for us. But how much better did it do for you, Rich? What is your spoiler-free rating for the book?
Overall,
yes,
I gave Deadhouse Gates a 4.25. I think it's really great.
Awesome. I gave it a 4 out of 5 stars. I think it's great.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
What was the best category for you and some of the worst?
I mean, best is probably the world building.
Okay. Yeah.
I give that one. I would say the lowest would be, for me, it'd be prose, but I'll be honest, it's not that low. So, I mean, it's all great across the board. So it's,
yeah,
there's nothing bad about this book. It's all incredibly well done. So,
I have world and prose were the top ones for me for this book. And we're trying something new for this review. This is the first time we're shifting this a little bit. First, we'll show here's our total category breakdowns of how we actually did rate the book. So you could see what our overall thoughts were. But also, we're going to start when we get to the spoiler section right about now. So spoiler warning, for everybody. We're switching up our order so that it makes more sense that we talk about the plot first. And we're going to, instead of we start with emotional impact, now we're going to start with plot and go through all the story beats with plot, characters, etc., and then get into the meaning by the end of this review. So, Rich, plot. Yep. Spoilers again. This is spoilers for Deadhouse
spoilers.
Gates.
All right.
What'd you give plot out of 5 stars?
I gave it 4. Thought it was great.
Great plot.
Great plot.
Nice.
So what'd you give the plot?
I gave it a 4.25. Really great. I thought this was a stronger suit. Yeah.
So I have kind of the breakdown of the plot to give a...
Yeah.
So what we are going to be talking about. There's first is Coltane's Chain of Dogs and that whole plot line. Mm-hmm. Then there's Fleecen's whole group and her plot line. Diker's Witness, the basically kind of chained together with Coltane. He goes through some other stuff and then Coltane, so it's kind of mixed, but separate enough to mention. Then there's Kalam and Fiddler's Mission, with the, you know, Kalam being one of the bridge burners.
And they split off pretty quickly, too.
Yeah. And they also split off, but similar mission together. Then there's Mappo and Akarium's wandering around the desert.
That's an apt description. They do wander.
They're wandering around.
They be wanderers.
They're fiddling around. Then you have the Path of Hands and just everything to do with the whirlwind and the cult that follows with.
Yeah. So
that's generally, I think that kind of encompasses all of them.
Yeah, the books itself is split. There's a prologue, epilogue, but then there's four books within the book. Mm-hmm. The first one's titled Raraku, then the second one is Whirlwind, the third is The Chain of Dogs, and fourth is Deadhouse Gates. And through our five main character point of views there, I have the percentages here of who was our main characters. Diker took up about 33% of the point of view, then Felicin, then Kalam, then Fiddler, then Mappo. Those were the main characters that you were getting the story told from. Mm-hmm. And how to break this down into, hey, promise, progress, payoff of the story, what were we set off and promised from these characters, and how did the story start? What did you think about it too? So a lot at once, but let's ground us to why we felt that. Why did you feel the plot was great? Where did it start off, and what did you expect going in? Because set the scene of
to start with the biggest one, we were promised this mysterious thing called the Whirlwind. It's this magical, cult-connected, like, destruction and havoc event that has been prophesized, and we are going to see it. And our characters that we're following have some degree of an influence and involvement in it.
Yeah.
We're promised the whirlwind. We get the whirlwind. Promise. There was progress. You figure out how it happens and pay off, because it does. Then you have the bridge burners. They're like, all right, we're taking Absalar home, but also secretly, we're kind of also want to kill the Empress. So, like, that's our main mission. That's why we're here. And we're going to confront the Empress. Promise. Pay off. We do confront the Empress. We finally get to meet the Empress of the Malazan Empire. And through a little back and forth, we see, things were more complicated than meets the eye. The Empress lives to see another day because she has placated the bridge burners. Progress, payoff. Great. Awesome. Felicin.
Take a school report.
Yeah, no. Check box.
I promise
done.
I wasn't testing.
Felicin, we're promised, like, just tragedy. Like, this one's going to suffer. This one's going to suffer a lot, and this is going to be a downward spiral. That's what we get. Suffering, downward spiral. Promise, progress, payoff. Awesome.
Bada bang.
I don't think, then Mappo and Ikarium were like, we're going to find out some weird stuff here. We do find out some weird stuff with them. They were fine. And then lastly, I think one of the highlights of this book that people remember and I kind of always hear about is Coltane's Chain of Dogs.
Yeah.
That was not promised in the book. There's a lot of dogs in the book, like on the book cover, the display, but still, that was awesome. I loved every second of that. It was thrilling. So I love that plot point. And we'll talk about each one of, like, what it actually brought to it. So which one do you want to start with?
I think the book starts with Felicin.
Sure. Right? Let's start with Felicin.
We get the prologue in, and it starts with Felicin in line with Haborik and Bowden. God, did I say those names right? Oh, damn.
Maybe.
I might be on blur knows? Right now. Who knows? You let us know. But with Haborik and Bowden, Felicin at this point is... it is in a line. She is enslaved and she's looking at her sister. Her last name's Perron. She's looking at her sister who seems like betrayed her. And she is with Haborik, who is this excommunicated priest who has no hands and has these tattoos from toe to head. It's just a very cool description to start the book off with. And then Bowden's this big tough guy who we come to find out later was there to protect her, but that's later stuff. So starts off in this line, Felicin gets sent to these mines, and her story right from the get-go, why you felt all that tragedy coming, is she she uses her body to get food and to help Haborik and Bowden. And she gets this Stockholm-esque syndrome, weird relationship, makes sense, as in just wrong relationship with the other character that starts with a B, not Bowden, but I think, but the other.
The not important.
That gets, that's only there in the beginning.
King of the yeah. slaves, basically.
That setup for me, of looking at all the setups, I was immediately more invested in that story, going, okay.
Connected. I am with you.
Yeah.
I will say right from the get-go, the plot line I was the most invested in and character was Felicin.
Yeah, I think a part of that too is you're connected with, okay, she's feeling vengeance toward her sister, automatic conflict. Mm-hmm. She's also throughout the story, the more interesting part is this thing gets into later after they get out of the mines because they get helped from, well, we'll skip ahead with this one, then go back to other character plot points, but gets helped from Diker because Diker sends, I think it's Culp, to send a ship or like help Haborik, because Diker knows Haborik, is that right? I'm getting my names right.
I believe so, yeah.
And then they escape after they make it out. She has this throughout the story before she becomes the Shaik. She is extremely bratty, but went through awful trauma. And so it's this back and forth of, you know, I understand exactly why you are this way.
She is right to... She has reasons to be as awful as she is.
Yes.
But here's the key thing. She's awful to the people that are trying to help her the most. Mm-hmm. And it's just self-destructive. The amount that she does have a point of, I think, really early on when she's on the, you know, slave ship, that they're on the bottom. And like a lot of people die on the slave ships due to just contamination, disease, all these different things. And by, you know, selling herself, using her body with the captain, she is able to get Haborik and Bowden like actually some real food and take them above like topside so they don't die on the way to the prison camp.
And she feels, hey, you both owe me. And
which maybe.
And they're
that's pretty justified. It's pretty understandable.
And they're having their own conversation. She feels left out and she's getting more bitter over time. So you see why she becomes a Shaik.
Yeah.
And so that's coming from her angle of her setup already. I was going, okay, I'm already more invested in these characters than I was in anything from Gardens of the Moon. So yeah. That was the setup. But why I thought the plot was really great. So setup from Felicin and the other point of views that we have. So we have Mappo and Ikariam, we have Diker, and then we have the Fiddler Kalam stuff. Diker, and we get introduced to Coltane, which we'll talk all about in characters, of course, but their plot line there, I feel like, is the focal point of the book, the Chain of Dogs. That that even though, you know, Apocalypse is happening, Rebellion's happening, but Chain of Dogs is the thing everybody remembers from Dead House Gates and Malazan. So that... How was that set up? How did you say earlier that you didn't feel like we were promised Chain of Dogs? Did I get that right? Or
I mean, in the beginning, it's not like promise to us. It's not like it's set up. Unlike where from the first couple chapters,
yeah,
the Whirlwind is mentioned frequently.
Yes.
The fact that the Bridgeburner's ultimate mission is mentioned frequently, like this is early on stuff. We're not really promised the chain of dogs, but what we get is pretty awesome.
Hey, so. Apocalypse Rebellion. I'm assuming there's some fighting.
True.
And with the way that starts the catalyst for that is it Kalam that has the book and gives it to the Shaik, starts the apocalypse. And Shaik dies right after giving the book, seconds later. And from because Kalam was being followed by the Red Cloaks, they saw him. Oh, he was tricked into being given the book so they could kill the Shaik or whatever the plot line was there. But that, yeah. What did you think? So setting up the book, we have Felicin in one court in the mines getting out because of Diker's help. Diker is a historian following Coltane. He is there while Coltane is now in control of the 7th Malazan Empire's army, the 7th Legion. I'm using the wrong word, Legion, but I was on a roll, okay? So I just felt like I should go an extra step. But
the Malazan 7th Army, yeah.
Malazan 7th Army, yes. And Whirlwind occurs. We get a lot of the bulk of the book, a lot of the progress, what kept you invested? Because, you know, we're setting up the scene. will happen throughout that. For me, the impressive part was each plot point interweaving, and it was cool when they split, came back, and yeah.
That's it. They're not like, oh, it all weaves into one plot line. No, there are still separations, but many of the plot points touch on one another.
Yes.
And in important ways, of like the obvious one of Diker and Felicin, and the fact that Diker is the one with the connection to Haboric is actually able to free them. So that's important. Then Diker's connection to Coltane, then also with the Bridgeburners and, you know, Kalam, and all of these things kind of hinge around each other. Then ultimately you have Absalar and
Crocus and Fiddler. Absalar,
Crocus and Fiddler.
Those characters are,
you know, they're on their own until they're connected to Mappo and Ikarium. And then end, in some, not actually directly, but are important to Felicin's story with the Whirlwind.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things, like, I'm just very impressed of the detail of this plot.
Yeah.
And all of these plot lines were important and intersect, but not all, you know, hey, all our characters come together at the end. And
No. It weaves back and forth. They come together, separate, come together, especially with Kalam and Fiddler splitting at the get-go. And Kalam's, he goes on ships. He's traveling around. We can't get to every specific plot point, of course, but the ending, the payoff for this story.
You want to go with Kalam first then?
Yeah.
Kalam next?
Yeah. The ending for Kalam, quote unquote, sees Empress Lassine, Lansine. And I thought, after I finished reading that page, I thought I would be disappointed that's it. And then I thought about it and went, I'm actually not disappointed by that. Did that work for you not seeing Emperor Lansine? Yeah.
Yeah. It's a combination of like, okay, Empress Lassine, because in book one, you kind of think like, man, this Empress kind of sucks. Like, she's pretty bad at her job and like losing the bridge burners. And like, why are you deliberately alienating your best fighters and best men and all this stuff? And just the amount of chaos. And then realizing that, oh, actually the Empress deliberately like fractured her army to give the enemy, like, basically she has a common enemy and she wants to look weaker so people will ally with her to fight a common enemy, which we don't know about quite yet. We know it's Ovidus, and we'll find out more about him. And so, she is clearly far more intelligent than we are led to believe in book one. And yeah, the fact that she knew that Kalam was kind of coming, or to some degree, and had a way around it. It's like, okay, there's a reason she's on the throne.
And you think, in a lot of epic fantasies, you know who the big bad is. Who is the big bad of Malazan?
I don't know. I don't think there is one. At this point,
there's a lot of.
I mean, we found at one point we were like, is Shadow Throne the big bad? Nope, not really. He's the new kid on the block of the gods. People don't know. He's a guy with dogs. That's what he is.
Yeah.
He's the guy with cute puppies.
And we have the biggest payoff of the whole book was a chain of dogs. Said it. How was seeing Coltane and him in command of the Seventh Army, and then ultimately Coltane dying?
Okay, as far as plot goes, and just choosing which perspective to watch and like see how the events unfold, that was the best choice of this whole book. Picking Diker to watch Coltane instead of being in Coltane's head was far more enjoyable. It's such a basic trick. Like, it almost was silly at a certain point, but I enjoyed every second of it, of Diker just kind of screaming his head off of like, we're all dead. What are we going to do? We're surrounded. There's nothing. All hope is lost. And then Coltane is like, he's like, I got this. And the unveiling of his master plan. And then ultimately like, oh, wow. He did it. Coltane did it. But he sacrificed like half of his army to save half of the army. And it's like, well, half is better than all. He keeps making that kind of decision on and on, but like everyone keeps saying, like, there's no way the Malazan army is going to survive. There's no way, like, they are surrounded all sides. They're outnumbered 10-1. There's nothing they can do. They are going to die.
Because you then have Komolo Don was the fist that is fighting against Coltane at the end. Because after he survives all these ordeals of one of them was he has the sappers were the goats in this book. The sappers just kept planting bombs or
oh yeah.
That was set up that one.
It's a carry on from book one of. Yeah. One of the things you liked about it is seeing the Malazan arm is a little different, and it reminds me of just like, I don't know. I always see the Malazan army exemplify like the indomitable human spirit of there's a line in this book or something like the thing that makes the Malazan army different and great is that they allow their soldiers to think, you know, like actually being creative and like rewarding excellence and ingenuity, and the sappers just being far more, you know, yeah, they are the heroes of this story coming up with all these different bombs and tricks and dug tunnels.
I love the lore. They didn't even have a leader.
Oh yeah.
It's just that they had a facade of a leader where they just all collectively do the shit they need to do.
Oh yeah. No, they just don't want to go to meetings. It's like, wait, like, people keep calling
what a
us.
Waste of time.
Just send an email. Like, we're too busy. None of this. And so, like, oh yeah, why isn't your commander here? It's like, oh well, he's stuck over. Who knows? I'll take a message. What do you need done? Got it.
It's great.
I love them. They're so great.
They were the best. I think they'd beat the bridge burners. I think they'd do it. And
as an abstract thing, yeah. I just love their organization. And so, also, it's hilarious when like Coltane basically figures it out. He's like, fine.
Whatever.
Fine.
Coltane has two personalities. He's like, fine, sappers, do what you want. You're helping me. And then Nobles, screw you. I'm going to do everything to make your lives miserable. rightfully so.
But how exciting was that of the several different moments, but of course, one of the big pivotal moments of where they're trapped on one side of the river. And Coltane's like, Diker's going like, we're doomed. And you see like Coltane's doing something. And then Diker sees something odd of like, those carts are like really heavy. Are they carrying the people across right now? No, it doesn't seem that way. So you see the little things of a plan. And then ultimately that's basically the secretly Coltane was building a type of like collapsible bridge across the river that allows all the carts to run across. Mm. But he had like all the things he had to do to get that of like making sure that the nobles didn't ruin his plans.
Right.
And try and save their own hide at the cost of everyone else.
Yep.
And even though he had this masterful plan, he still lost a lot of people. But again, he saved enough.
And the tragedy in the end, because he did everything he could to have this army survive, then Fist Porkwell goes, oh, Komodo Don will certainly, look, let's just go outside of our city walls and show fealty. And you just see Komodo Don, and I hope I'm saying his name right. I know I'm not. But you Coltane's death of, I guess we can wait for more moments when we get later into the pod, but Coltane's death hit hard. It's just the description of his death and the crucifixion and.
But ultimately, what a great man that is like. One, he's just such a practical guy, like this larger than life character. And then ultimately, it seems very futile.
Yeah.
And ultimately, kind of is. Like, the Seventh is, like, mostly massacred down, and the rest of them are, you know, chained up. But there's something fun and interesting about the nobility of this. Like, they did more than anyone expected of them. Even though they all died at the end, they died by betrayal. It wasn't that they were outflanked, like, they exceeded everyone's expectations, and there's some type of glory in that, even though they lost.
And you don't expect the 16th seed to beat the first seed in March Madness, but if they make it close and it's an 80-79 game, you go, you lost, but wow, that was entertaining.
Yeah.
Wow, bravo. Essentially.
Basically, yeah.
That is, so Coltain, I want to go to the other big ones. We can always go back to when we go into Coltain's character, but rest of the plot, we had Ikariam and Mappo. We'll focus on what characters, but their plot point is very interesting setup of Mappo, or sorry, Ikariam, his memory's gone. Mappo, we start off knowing what are the intentions here and figure out over the book, oh, he is with Ikariam and he needs to make sure Ikariam doesn't get his memory back. This rageful, he seems to have more power than anybody. He could do, he could decimate cities.
If he remembers.
If he remembers. So there's that threat in the background. And then I'll be as the, okay, great plot.
Which, tragic plot line story of just setting it up. And I think you do find out pretty early on. I mean, not that early, but the friendship between Mappo and Ikariam are clearly close.
Yep.
And you start getting attached to them. And then Ikariam being like, oh, it's his mission that the Mappo is following Ikariam, trying to find his memories back. Mm-hmm. And ultimately Mappo is in some way betraying his friend by always scrubbing and leading him away from getting his memories.
Yep.
Because he's supposed to kill him. That ultimately he's leading him away from his memories because he doesn't want to kill his friend, but he's supposed to kill his friend because he's too much of a threat. And so real tragic, sad, but I loved it.
And I thought it was a great plot, really great plot. Then the parts where I was less invested, I couldn't get as invested in Fiddler or Crocus Apsler story as I wanted to. Tell me, were you, or was there something about it that, how would you say their plot points? Interwolf.
I liked them well enough.
Yeah.
They were fine. But yeah, I was not invested in them as nearly the same.
Why not?
I didn't particularly know the direction they were going. Like, they're trying, they're kind of following Kalam's path, but it's more of a story of survival of them just trying to get across the desert. It's really it.
Because we didn't like book one? They're the only ones that carry over a lot with the goal is get Apsler back to her dad.
Yeah, but we liked Kalam a lot more. Kalam was really better. But the main thing is the promise, progress, payoff of it. I didn't particularly know what was being promised with them. They seemed very much like an afterthought, and they're just going from scene to scene trying to survive, which is entertaining enough. It's fine. It's just not as good as the other sections. And then,
but then you have the actual Deadhouse Gates.
The Deadhouse Gates was cool world building stuff. But by that time, we're with Mappo and Ikariam, and so
it makes it more interesting. Yeah,
exactly. The more interesting dynamic between the three of somewhat entertaining is, Fiddler is actually funny. So Fiddler's dialogue is entertaining as a character. Apsler is so far, she. Most of her mystery and mystique is kind of gone. There is still the mystery of who's in control, all this stuff, but her presence is gone from book one. Book one, she had presence. Mm. This, not so much. So the kind of, not love triangle, but kind of relationship dynamic between her, Fiddler, and what's his name?
Crocus. Which we can dive into for character stuff, too.
But. Sure. That was some of the better parts of the book of, Fiddler. There's a couple funny lines of Fiddler, seeing Apsler and being attracted to her and going, nope, remember how crazy she is. Remember.
The hot crazy scale is not worth
it. No. Remember, she's not so. Don't do it. Don't do it.
She's nutso. Don't look at the butso. It's like he's just trying to remind himself constantly.
Yeah,
too.
She's nuts. Don't do it.
Exactly.
And yeah.
Yes. And we have, those are essential plot points. The payoff that we get from this book, I think, is it's all the marbles are on the Chain of Dogs and the Coltain Diker plotline, whereas I think the the Felicin stuff, the Mappo Ikarium, the Fiddler, all that. You get mini paths, the Lancine confrontation we get with Kalam, but all those feel more set up for later series stuff, even though Chain of Dogs is going to be, I assume, mentioned as well.
It's weird that, how everything is tied to that plot line and yet ultimately doesn't matter by the end. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I find that interesting.
But that is the plot line that, I'm saying this with, of course, there's going to be more depth to it, but ends. That is okay. Chain of Dogs, that is the payoff of this book, and then we'll see where, because a lot of them ended on, oh, what's going to happen next for other several characters. So I liked that we had a payoff of sorts and then setting up grander things for the future books that you get excited for. But I think, do you have anything else for plot-wise before you want to dive into characters and motivations and all that?
I did want to mention a highlighted plot sequence for me.
Yes, which part?
The ghost ship.
Oh, yeah.
I loved the ghost ship. The ghost ship was so cool. It's so weird. It was such a weird plot point. But just the fact of, like, one, I loved how much, I love how it was set up. So the ending scene with the ghost ship is like, now the couple of these members that were with Felice and these soldiers are now, like, basically have a... You good?
Yeah, I think I just broke my back. Okay. I think Nick could hear that crack. I don't know if that came in the audio, but well, yeah, sorry.
But they now have basically control of the ghost ship that is, you know, rowed by a bunch of headless creatures that are the same as Mappo or Ikarium. One of them.
Trell or Jags. I'm going to mix it up, so sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
And then a couple of them, or at least one, is close to godhood now, apparently. That's a thing. And we're like, oh, okay. And then they're kind of going
ascendancy?
Off.
Ascendancy?
Yeah, they're close to.
Coltane was too, right? There's all this ascendancy stuff going on. Yeah,
that was a whole confused thing, which I was interested. Like, mm-hmm. Coltane, like, hit this guy, and this guy was injured, but not. Like, they basically realize, like, that guy is really close to ascendancy. But the fact that Coltane was even able to hurt him means
he's close.
He's close to what the hell's going on here? Huh?
Yeah. But that's this god and the ghost ship thing. Yes.
Coming out.
Yep.
Just like, now we have a ghost ship going around.
Cool.
That kind of plot point in book one, ghost ship would have just appeared. And then, like, they come out, it's like, hey, Coltane, here's things and help. I'm helping out. Bye-bye, I got a ghost ship. And then they leave. In this book, it's, you know, like, we get to discover the ghost ship with the characters.
You hear the ice cream truck before you see it.
Yes, that's great. And now I feel in. I feel in on the jokes. I feel in on the world building.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the ghost ship. That was fun.
A really great plot. Yeah, impressive that when you think of the book, it like you said, over time, it grew better on you. I read the book more recently because I could already see over time it sticking in my mind better than it already is now.
Yeah.
I'm just going, okay.
I know I'm missing things. I'm not able to give the right word to some things. I know stuff is falling through the cracks, but this is a very complicated book, and I'm remembering a hell of a lot for something that I've read a while ago, and that's because it's a really memorable plot.
Yes. And the epilogue, I'll just read straight off of the wiki for this because I had a tough time understanding what the epilogue was doing. So you can help explain. But back on the Wiccan Plains, a pregnant young widow learns from a horsewife that her child is an empty vessel without a soul. As she moves to drink the medicine that will abort the child, the sky suddenly fills with dark clouds. The horsewife, fear and hope on her face, stops the widow from drinking. The clouds descend on the widow, revealing themselves to be thousands of crows. Within the widow's womb, a child stirs. Now, is that Coltane?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I have that right.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
Yes. So Coltane was deliberately not killed
fully.
Basically, they wanted him to, they were trying to make him suffer and keep his, because Coltane, along with the other, like, not mages, but the Wiccans, and they have their own kind of system of magic, the way they do it, they are reborn.
Yeah.
And crows are a vital portion to that somehow. So, like, you have children that are like 11 and they've actually gone through multiple generations and, like, the soul of, you know, someone who's a couple hundred years old. And so when they killed Coltane, the flock of crows came and basically took his soul with him to be reborn later, just like just like the other Wiccans.
Making sure I got that right. So it is Coltane. Yes. Okay.
It is Coltane.
And that is okay. So
if it isn't, that's a weird.
It's got to be the it's crows. Gotta be. It has to be the crows.
I mean, we both.
I agree with you. Your interpretation.
It has to be. If it isn't, that's weird. But fine.
So, so to put a cap on the plot portion, overall, why would you say it was great? What did it not do anything well for you when you look back to the plot of any complaints you have? Why is it not the best ever?
Ultimately, I mean, the Path of Hands, it was really in the background. I don't know if I was as invested in that, along with everything with Apsalar and Fiddler and all them. So not as good as the others.
I think that's the thing, because when you have an epic fantasy multi-POV book, even for some of my five-star books, there's a POV you don't want to get to a lot of the times, but it's how much does the amazing POV compensate for the ones that you're less invested in? And this one, I think I was the Diker Coltane stuff and the Felicin were the two point of views I was the most invested in. And
I agree.
Even though I enjoyed the Kalam stuff at times, it was, you know, assassinate Empress Lancine. And even though the payoff was good, payoff wasn't incredible. It was, all right, cool. I see that it added some world building and lore stuff rather than that being a crazy plot moment. I was like, oh, okay, when we talk world building, we can get into that. But yeah, those plots were more straightforward and I was there. Yeah, they were going on. But you want to go on the characters?
Yeah, let's go to characters.
Let us know, by the way, if you appreciated the new system of us going to plot first and characters and then getting to the themes and messages by the end. So it's us talking about the story and then building across.
This is a hard one to start with. It is Malazan, so the plot's a little complicated.
It is.
Apologies for how we discussed it in kind of out of order-ish, but whatever. We're doing our best.
Let us know. Okay. Characters. What did you give characters out of 5 stars?
4.25. Really great.
Okay, we flipped. I gave this one 4 stars.
Great. Yep.
So I slightly like the plot more. You slightly like character more. I see. But who was your favorite?
Felicin.
Felicin.
Felicin was my favorite character.
I think she was mine too.
She's the most compelling character out of all of them. It was just so juicy of a storyline to get behind, the watching this character self-destruct in this downward spiral and like just be enveloped in bitterness and in hate. And by the end of it, pushing away everyone that tried caring for her, and ultimately the greater tragedy of like the discovery that Bowden, who eventually left, like he was sent there to protect her, like her sister was trying to protect her in some way of like she couldn't directly do it. Fair enough. She chose the Empire over her sister, but she's like, okay, I'm going to do what I can. I'm going to send Bowden, who's clearly incredibly powerful, should be enough to protect Felice and to get her out and like protect her along the way. And it seems almost in a way that Felice and kind of threw away this opportunity to save herself and help her. And she's just pissed away these opportunities and relationships.
She's a severely flawed character. Mm-hmm. But which is why, and you see why her motivation.
She's also incredibly young.
Exactly, she's young.
Yeah,
her motivation's clear from the get go. Of why are we following Fleeson's point of view? Okay, she's connected to the Perron. She's connected to Perron. Wants this revenge against her sister. We also are then invested in the grander story because we know Perron's from last book, so that's the start. And then we get on top of that all the brutal stuff that happens to her in the beginning of rape and her selling her body and everything that
but
is going on in
very,
part one of that story.
Very quickly coping mechanism of it starts off small, but then because she's already because she's already being used like that, she in some way tries to take an ownership of it, of making it, instead of this being forced upon me, it is now my choice, and in that way trying to take some control of her situation.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, she's given several opportunities of help. She's a hand reaches out to her several times to try and pull her back out of this situation, but she just doubles down.
Yeah.
Oof. But then on top of it, I felt like an equal amount of anger toward the characters around her. Of, yeah, they were trying to help her, but also pretty quickly on, they just started to look down on her and dismiss her. It angered me.
Was part of that them talking without her involved? Talking
without her involved, and then ultimately basically like dismissing her as like, oh yeah, you wanted this. Like, you just want to be a whore to these slavers and all this stuff. And it's like,
She was getting them food.
Clearly not. She's like, do you think she actually wanted it? And how much she has sacrificed and suffered for them and giving them food and helping them and ultimately being in this terrible situation.
And the way they see it, Bowden, or the big prisoner guy that she's with that dies for her, he looks at her sleeping with the other guy that starts with a B, and she always talks so fondly of him. And I imagine that frustrates Bowden. I hope I'm saying that. Yeah, Bowden. It frustrates him because he's looking and going, no, he was using you. He didn't care about you. And he keeps telling her to her face, yeah, guess what he said behind your back? Like, he cared nothing. And Felicien gets more pissed off at Bowden for saying all these bad things and vows to kill him. And then they sleep together. And which was just a sudden scene. She tries to kill Bowden and he just wakes up and goes, no, I knew you were going to.
Well, no, and just how much of that was kind of a final scene of like seeing like,
yeah,
let's see how far you've fallen and
all the way.
I know who you are.
Yeah.
It just one also how I liked the scene with her on the beach with the other soldiers and her trying to gain some favor and trying to sell herself to the soldiers for some type of advantage. And it just doesn't work.
Oh, and yes. That's
basically
a good
all of them reject her. And they
laugh at her pretty much.
Yeah. And you just see kind of she felt that she had this because she is beautiful. She's pretty and all that. She had some power. And she had a card to play.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally that card is spent. And now it doesn't work. And now she just thinks to herself like, why bother? Like if even this is not worth it, then why did I start this path in the first place? And it seems very futile. Yeah. And especially by the end of her realizing like Bowden was sent by her sister. So this whole motivation of revenge was actually maybe not completely ill-founded, but partly. Right. And that Bowden was protecting her this entire time and trying to look out for her, and she pushed him away. And same thing with Haboric.
And Haboric, just an interesting character to start with, of tattoos head to toe, no hands, and then his hands he's able to use by the end. What's going
on
there?
He's got ghost hands.
The description of his character is what got me invested to begin with him. I was going, wow, that is an excommunicated priest in prison with tattoos, no hands, and connected to Diker. What's going on with him? And so he was just appearance-wise the most clear to me, whereas anybody else in their point of views that you want to talk about? Felicien and Haboric Bowden, those are the main three. We can't get to everybody, obviously, but then we have you can feel free to go back, but I'll toss out another name. Go to Mappo Akirium, but also Iscarel Pust.
Oh yeah, he was funny.
Those are the three main from their point of view.
Iscarel Pust filled the same role as Kruppa in book one.
Yes. Yep.
Kruppa was like your pure comic relief character, and that was Iscarel Pust. Funny, but also clearly like there was more to him, which same thing with Kruppa.
Mm-hmm.
What'd you think of Iscarel Pust?
Yeah. He was quirky. Quirky character, and I didn't know if he was supposed to be a god at some points or some ascendant, something that I didn't understand, because he was weird enough that he's just in this tower of sorts. I'm going, who is this guy? And I guess I was just curious who he actually is.
Sure. As far as I know from this book, he's a servant of Shadow Throne.
Mm-hmm.
And I think is just more funny because seeing, judging the tree by its fruit of this Iskaral Pust is the best Shadow Throne can do. Like, really? Aw, that's sad. It's like, oh man, Shadow Throne's kind of on hard times if this is his follower.
Yeah.
And he's kind of all alone. It's pathetic, but very funny.
And I think the Mappo and Ikariam, their relationship of Mappo having to constantly keep Ikariam's past from him. Mm-hmm. And by the end, we figure out, oh, can he do it? Can he betray a friend that he's made on this journey in order to actually save
everyone
in the long run? And he can't. Yep. Can't do it. This book has that pattern of characters, just a general vibe of tragedy in a general sense. Not this book's over and everybody's dead and there's no good, but just this book was, more so in the tragic sense.
But here's the thing. Most of these characters in some way failed, but not in a completely depressive way. The fact that Coltane failed, but it was still glorious. It is remembered. It is something aspirational to see, like, Coltane's story. Like, it's, I don't know, it's more, he failed, but it's uplifting. Same thing.
Will his story be told correctly? That's the question, because that's another one. Dyker's dead.
Yeah.
The one who's supposed to hold the history.
That was tragic.
And that whole scene with, again, going to Pormquall, or the fist that is saying, hey, Kamoral Don, they're going to be on good terms, and then brings the whole army out there. Oh, yeah, we'll lay down our arms, of course. And just lets it happen. And all, you see the whole book, the hard work Coltane put in to save everybody, and it goes away in just a flash because of this
idiot.
And you're going, oh, well, that, okay. And yeah, Dyker's death and Dyker's character. How'd you view him?
I saw him more as a throughput. Like, he is the POV to see other plot points, not particularly him himself.
He's the Great Gatsby, not Gatsby.
Yeah. sad ending, and more tragic of Dyker being the friends with, what's his name? Haboric.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And at the very end, Haboric being blinded but able to see dead souls and things like that, that he's standing underneath his friend's corpse and ultimately is not able to see him. But also, Dyker didn't exactly die either. Kinda. Remember? He had a little... the device, like the item that was for Coltane, was on Dyker, and so his soul is kind of spirited away in some fashion.
Like, so who knows? It could be back.
Oh. Yeah, no, we don't know about him.
Anybody can come back. That's what we've learned.
It's also one of the reasons probably why Haboric couldn't see Dyker and couldn't see his friend, but it was a tragedy of like him standing, like trying to find his friend and ultimately can't see him.
Yeah.
Sad, real sad. But something that I want to kind of right off the bat, something we didn't talk about in plot, probably should have mentioned, because it's a big reveal, I think. And we can talk about the character here. Shadow Throne.
Yes.
In this book, we find out that this god Shadow Throne that was introduced in book one, this mysterious new god on the plane who apparently wants to kill the Empress, was influencing Apsalar, all this stuff, is actually the former emperor of the Malazan Empire. Which is like, okay. Oh. So now you see like the connection with Quick Ben and all these other... It just brings down the godly level to...
another degree.
Well, no, it's just like gods are just really, really close to humans. Like, they can just... up here. Okay.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Yeah. I think that was more not character, because here's the thing. Just in general, Steven Erikson's characters, right? I think it's tough when you have so many in a cast of that's a cool world thing. Yeah.
It's a cool world thing, but also I like the description of Shadow Throne and how he talks to Quick Ben and all these little things is very enjoyable.
Oh, yeah. I think the just in general with a lot of these characters, because it's multi-POV and there's such a clear tone with the book as well. Mm-hmm. It's some of the characters can overlap at times and just feel that they are okay. In general, Shadowthorn, for example, I didn't even think of to talk about as a character, which I guess what do you mean about their character? Did it impress me? Because I don't know if there's a character point
that
I could make.
Fun as a character is Shadowthorn crazy or not? And what I'm just very curious about him as a character of what does he actually want? I'm very curious about him. Mm-hmm. It seems like, does godhood like make you a little bit crazy? Was he crazy before? I mean, maybe you have to be a little crazy if you like try to ascend to godhood and you basically abandon the empire. Very confused. Mm. And I was really interested by that whole plot reveal and I want to know more about this character.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. I'm definitely on a we'll see what happens with. Yeah, I agree with that. What do you think? Was there another standout character for you?
I mean, Coltane.
Coltane, yes. Coltane. So, getting Coltane's perspective from Dyker, and what scene got you connected or interested in Coltane? Do you remember?
I mean, pretty darn early on when he took control of the Malazan 7th and started training them in more inventive ways and being a hard ass, but also not for no reason. He's clearly dedicated to making the 7th actually an effective fighting force and being scrappy. Scrappy's the right word.
Yeah, scrappy.
He's a scrappy guy. But no, that was always enjoyable seeing his kind of creative ways at training. Mm-hmm. And then just pretty early on, his early victories of just hearing that, Dyker going, oh, Coltane, he must be dead. Like, the whirlwind has wiped him out. Mm. And then hearing, like, oh, Coltane they're still marching. Like, oh, they're still going. And just hearing all the whispers of Coltane's victory on the wind is, you're just so invested in this character.
Yes, and you see all of this. You start to think that Coltane is invincible.
Yeah.
No, and maybe he is because he comes back in future books. I don't know. But he is. Yeah, he had the, as Salty who loves Malazan say, the gas. He had the gas. He had all the gas. And I think from most of these characters, I'm looking to ones we didn't mention that are prominent. Any prominent ones that we didn't mention? So Dyker we talked about. Kalam, more specifically to Kalam and Fiddler, their characters. Did anything work or not work with them for you?
I have the character list written down.
Good.
Oh God, there's so many.
Well, while you're looking
there's
at that,
so many.
What do you think of Kalam's decision to not try to kill Lancine, Empress Lancine?
I mean, it makes sense. It's in some ways, other people could maybe see it as anticlimactic, where, God, I cannot speak, anticlimactic, that, you know, he does all of this. He trudged across the desert through the whirlwind just to get an opportunity to kill Lancine. And then ultimately, she just kind of has a 5-minute conversation with him. And he's like, oh, all right, well, I'll leave.
Turn around,
leave.
Yeah.
But it makes sense of she does adequately convince him of she ultimately is on their side. She didn't really betray the emperor, kind of. Like, there's more to it there. And she didn't betray the bridge burners. And she didn't betray the other general that we saw, that they've been in cahoots the entire time.
Right.
So, makes sense why he leaves her alone and goes off.
Yeah.
Also, he kind of gets his happy ending. He gets the woman. He goes into the dead house gates, and it's like, oh, that's nice. We'll see if he pops out. Who knows?
Yeah.
Pretty quick. Also, speaking of a character, oh God, yes. I'm probably not going to find her. But
which character?
the woman that
Kalam likes?
That Kalam
picks up. Oh, it starts with an M.
Starts with an M?
Yes. I do Minerva or maybe not. But yes, Minilla? Maybe Minilla?
Sure. Let's go with that. I don't even know if it's on my list of characters.
I'm looking right now just to double check.
There's too many characters. Way too many characters.
But yes, that character that you're talking about.
Whatever. Anyway, for the limited amount of page time, I think she made a pretty big impact on me. I liked her. She got spunk, and you understand why, Kalam...
Protect the children.
Kalam likes her, and it's like, I don't know. It was kind of happy. It was like, oh, spunk. Good for him. It was like, good. He got a good ending. I'm happy for him.
Good.
Yeah. Don't kill the Empress. Live out in the weird mystery house. Taking care of some weird children. For Shadow Throne, because he's apparently collecting a lot of orphans.
For some reason. So.
Okay.
Do you want to start talking world building?
Yeah.
Well, huh. What'd you give that out of 5 stars?
4.5. Same. Spectacular.
4.5, spectacular.
Spectacular world building. Oh,
how do you break this down?
Jesus Christ. How do you break this down?
We can't do a line by line of here's what happened in this world. Here's the world building tidbits we got.
I think I do actually have it. Here are the big world building elements.
Oh, please go.
To discuss. Yeah. First is the whirlwind.
Okay. Yep.
And all that encompasses that, because I think that is the central world building element that we get from beginning to end. Okay. Full development through across the different POVs and how it is built up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the most significant. The ghost ship and everything that kind of
ghost ship
falls with it. We get a little bit more about the wardens and just how the magic works in this series. Along with that, the Warden of Paths. So the Path of the Hand and like this ascendancy to godhood. So we get more of that. Ikarium.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big section of the world building.
Oh, him seeing the destruction of the city.
Yeah.
And not knowing it was him mm-hmm. that caused it, yes.
And then also his connection to the clock. Oof.
Yeah.
Also not knowing its clock, which was very interesting. Apparently that's a novel thing in this world. Okay. Then Shadow Throne. Shadow Throne was another big element of world building lore that we built on it. Also, was it in this book that Quick Ben... goes to Shadow Throne or something like. Which one is Quick Ben? Like quickly makes a deal with, or no? Was that was last book?
Makes a deal.
Quick Ben makes a deal with Shadow Throne of like, hey, let go of Apsalar.
That's last book.
It is last book. Okay,
Gardens, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. And then it's Kalam this time that talks with Shadow Throne. Got it. Yeah, just the fact that this guy's the former emperor and he apparently has schemes and plans. He's doing something.
Yeah.
And he's the new god on the block and all the other gods are kind of like, who is this asshole? Yeah, it's enjoyable.
I can't say I understand all the world building, but it is a lot more the not hand-holding fashion of Steven Erikson and Molazin. Every tidbit now that you're experiencing, I'm trusting him more that it will pay off of, okay, it's connected to the plot, it's connected to where we're invested, but also the additions we got with the Trell, Jog, Talana Mas, I'm starting to understand more, especially the appendices or the back of the book helps, of these different founding races and Ikarium, for example, these, how do you put it? I saw a video online that I think Andy Smith, another booktuber posted this that was so good. It was looking at how all the work, it always assumes when you enter a new town or you enter a new area that every culture has mixed. There is no, even when you go to some location, it's just completely normal that there is a, how do you put it? Like when we see the chain of dogs and we go to a place that's like Hither was one of the cities that we went to, but just nobody is shocked by the peoples. Nobody is like going, oh my God. Even when someone runs into a god, for example, or when somebody runs it, just all of this is commonplace to everybody in the world. And so on the one hand, does that make you go as a reader go, oh, should I focus on this or not? So it's more so how many, the amount of times we see the world building thing is how much to focus on it. So how many times are you seeing that like the whirlwind was so important because through several plot points, like the whirlwind or whatever world building element is repeated rather than the kind of one-offs and the flashes that will probably be something later. But I guess how have you tried to make sense of the world? Because that's what I'm doing. I'm just looking for a repetition has helped me go, okay, I've seen that X number of times. That is something that has grand importance, because I don't know how often like you said, the last book, three dragons appear in this and should we care about that? I don't know.
Yeah.
This I'm looking for repetition.
To me, it's not the repetition per se. Something though else. You're right. It is frequency, like the whirlwind, the fact that it is present in every POV.
Yeah.
And clearly shows it's important. But it's more of the connection with our characters.
Yeah.
So the three dragons coming from the first book, how's that connected to our characters? I don't know. It just kind of happens and then it's gone. And like, was that important? I don't know. It just kind of, things were happening to characters I don't care about. In this one, the whirlwind is incredibly important to basically all of the characters, but most especially Felicin, and then Kalam is integral to this part, and then Apsalar, and like she thinking that she would be the Shike, and she's kind of being led to be that, but ultimately not. And then the whirlwind itself being a mix of this magical doomsday apocalypse thing, but also ultimately just a revolution. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Of like,
it's a rebellion.
It's just a rebellion.
Yeah.
At the heart of it, most of the damage is not the magical, like, moving whirlwind.
Mm-hmm.
That's like there and like, ooh, it's weird because it's kind of like a controlled whirlwind. That's not really the most influential part of it. It's the fact that it started, and then the people on the, you know, in Raraku are just swarming the Malazan troops. And so that's the whirlwind.
Yes.
So how much of that is just, you know, rebellion or magic?
Mm-hmm.
So I like all that stuff.
Yeah. I'm going to sit quietly and observe the world is my take. I think this is one of the ones that we have to keep reading to figure out what. I can't talk intelligently about it until read and find out. Rafo.
Yeah.
Rafo for a lot of the world stuff. But you said the Path of Hands too. Did you find that? You said the plot points wasn't as fun, but the Path of Hands as a world building concept.
Yeah.
You liked a lot more.
It's interesting. Yeah. That was what I was invested in, going, oh, this is an interesting mystery. It's tied with Mappo Nacarium. It's tied with Shadow Throne and the Ascendancy. So it's there's some mysterious nature of, like, we got a lot more about mortals ascending to godhood. Mm. And what does that mean? And
right.
I was curious about all that. That's why I enjoyed it.
Cool. Anything else from world?
The ghost ship and the dragons there and the path, like the war in the paths.
Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah.
This time the dragons were cool. I liked the dragons this time.
This time, good.
This time, cool. Cool dragons.
What made them cool this time?
I don't know. The dragons were like, actually, they were affecting characters I cared about.
That's all it takes.
You know what I mean? I'm like, they're in the ghost ship and they're like, oh man, how much worse can it get? We're trapped in this warden of the warden of paths and all this. Oh no.
Mm-hmm.
And then dragon comes out and they're like, what the hell are you doing in my turf?
What's up?
Blazes fire, which apparently gives some of them like ascendancy, like godlike being abilities or bodies, whatever it is. And then they escape. And I'm like, okay, cool. Just, It worked. What can I say? It worked.
That was it?
Yeah. What about you?
Yeah, I guess that worked.
I feel like, okay, the standout world building element is the ghost ship. It's just there. You know what I mean? Of like, you could hypothetically cut out everything with the ghost ship and ultimately nothing changes.
Mm.
It's just the most weird of, you know, Haborik trying to save them and open a warden to escape being trapped on the sea. And then ultimately they're in this mysterious warden. They come across the ghost ship.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
I think that was, again, that was the coolest imagery too, seeing all of the dead bodies working the ship. And then the tidbit that we talked about as well with Coltane being ascendancy and what does that mean? And couple of the snippets of I guess the characters I cared about was the most interesting world building parts as well. So overall, well done.
Yeah. Do you have anything else?
Oh no, I'm being obtuse and purposefully quiet on world because I don't know enough.
Fair enough.
I was going, wow, this is impressive. I can't wait to find out more.
Yeah.
But did you have anything else as well?
Nope. No. Let's go into it.
Pros time then. Pros, what'd you give out of 5 stars?
Pros, I gave... Well, it's all at the top. You do it first.
I gave a 4.5-star spectacular pros.
I'll be honest, I don't know what I was thinking when I gave it a 3.75. You're right. It's probably should be higher.
Oh, then that. Oh, that's what you did give it.
I gave it a 3.75.
Mm-hmm.
That's wrong.
What is it then?
4.25.
Okay, really great.
Really great. Really great pros. I don't know what I was thinking there.
This pro, it was third person past tense, and he. What kind of, I guess, what is Steven Erikson's strength and style as an author? What do you feel?
I mean, with such a complicated plot, characters, and world, and being able to accurately describe things in a way that... Yeah, you don't understand why things are happening, but you do understand what is happening. That's impressive.
There are some the way he writes is unique too. It's unique of it. I guess that's where sometimes people can say they're confused as well. Is the prose can be hard to can be dense. So he's got this dense way of describing things. And here, I've got a line. If you have any lines as well as you're pulling yours up, but here's a quote from the book just to give you a sense of Steven Erikson's prose. He says, "Show me a mortal who is not pursued and I'll show you a corpse. Every hunter is hunted. Every mind that knows itself has stalkers. We drive and are driven. The unknown pursues the ignorant. The truth assails every scholar wise enough to know his ignorance, for that is the meaning of unknowable truths." So he always has these characters saying some wisdom or some sort of metaphors that you don't, maybe that when they're saying it, you don't fully understand it, but always some little bits of wisdom are in his writing.
To that point, there's another line I really liked of characters talking about, war and so character says, "Children are dying." Lull nodded. "That's a succinct summary of humankind, I'd say. Who needs tomes and volumes of history? Children are dying. The injustices of the world hide in those 3 words.
I have the one down too, damn it.
That was so good.
Yes.
Ooh. I was mentioning it before of what I really enjoy about the Malazan army and comparing them to other different armies and combat troops and all this is... Basically, this line of what makes a Malazan soldier so dangerous? They're allowed to think. Just, I don't know why that works and just that little bit of world building for it, but Coltane is a good example of it, of the Malazan army is just incredibly practical and forward thinking in the sense of like, hey, we just do what works. We don't care who you are, where you come from, like, we do what works.
Efficiency.
Coltane is this guy, like, maybe we don't trust him. He's this Wiccan and all that, but hey, he's good at what he does. Do it. Oh, he's not following protocol? Well, does it work? Great. Then we're going to keep doing it. Like, there's just this cold efficiency that is pretty fun with them.
Yes.
They're just very diverse in tactics and strategies. And the sappers being just a highlight of that.
Yeah. And each chapter opens up with some quotes. And sometimes you get quotes from, I think we got a quote about Coltane, which was cool to see as well. And you get these little, what do you call them? They're not poems of sorts, but they're just introductory epigraphs.
I got one of them here.
Oh, please read it. Yes.
Coltane rattles slow across the burning land. The wind howls through the bones of his hate-ridden command. Coltane leaves a chain of dogs, ever snapping at his hand. Coltane's fist bleeds the journey home along rivers of red-soaked sand. His train howls through his bones in spiteful reprimand. Coltane leaves a chain of dogs, ever snapping at his hand. Which is such a great way to describe it, of him trying to save as many people from this army as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. And ultimately,
that's a
constantly,
great description.
Like, just by strength of will alone,
oh,
like,
yeah.
I will save you whether you like it or not. You listen to me, you louse. Like, just,
the nobles. Force, yeah.
He's constantly having to fight everyone, even his own people, mm-hmm. to get the job done. So.
That was the best epigraph I remember. I'm glad you took that, because that was the one that I was going, oh, what a description. Any other ones that you have to pull up?
Oh, here, I got a couple.
Yeah. I have some of your favorites. Which is your favorite?
Let's see. Here's. I have two. So yeah. I'll just do it here. Do I see control on all sides, or the illusion of control? List face twisted sightly. Sometimes the two are one and the same, in terms of their effect, I mean. The only difference, or so Coltane says, is that when you bloody the real thing, it absorbs the damage, while the other shatters.
Nice.
Which is a great example of how Coltane is able to win, and like using illusions to actually trick the enemy, which is very fun.
Awesome. Do you want to go on to emotional impact?
Yeah, let's go through it.
What'd you give that out of 5 stars?
A 4.25.
4 for me. Great.
Yeah, I thought it was really great. Best I was really
moment,
invested.
Best moment, the visual of Coltane dying and the arrows flying through the air, the crows as he's being crucified. And then that entire sequence in the end with the chain of dogs was most visual, paid off. And we get to the tragedy of the moment, the frustration of the moment, all
of them being strung up and crucified along the line that goes like, what, 5 miles, 5 miles long of bodies.
Yeah. Come on. Whew. Come on. That there was the Lancine meetup, and in general, the Felice and Bowden Haborik, that I was so invested in them, and the mm-hmm. specific scenes we talked about with Felice and Bowden's back and forth, and that tragedy of that as well. Again, tragedy is a lot of the feel of the intended emotion that this was going for. What do you feel that Erickson's punch was trying to go for here?
I mean, ultimately we're going through, tragedy is probably the biggest one, but it's also about the same thing with book one, connections.
Yeah,
you're both the good and ill of it. So the I would say most of them, you see the history and connection that these characters have with each other, which does give people strength. It can also tear people down. Felicin's the probably greatest example of, because she pushes away connections with others, she spirals, versus someone like Apsalar, who in some situations, like, is a tragic figure herself of how much she's lost. But she does have she has made connections with other people.
Yeah.
And that has, in some way, saved her. Same thing with basically every single character. Mappo and Ikarium, the connection to others is what, you know, lifts us out of trouble. With Haborik and Diker.
Diker, yep.
You know, their friendship saves each other. You see Kalam able to, like, his connection with Quick Ben, his relationship mm-hmm. with the Empress. It, all of these things comes together.
I
think that's what he's trying to get at, is how important those emotional connections are. And so you start to feel it as well.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, that's a good. I didn't think of that thematically too. That works really well. That, I guess, for any other big scene besides the Coltane, the Chain of Dogs. I think when people read this book, Chain of Dogs, that is what everybody gravitates toward. Mm-hmm. Any other big thing? You love the ghost ship stuff.
I liked all the tension with Kalam. Kalam and the Empress. That was incredibly filled with tension. But yeah, the emotional pull was Felicin.
Awesome.
Felicin was the most enthralling character and the most emotionally impactful journey that I had.
Then I want to go into thought-provokingness.
Sure.
What'd you give that out of 5 stars?
4.25. Really great.
I gave 3.5. Good. Good stuff.
Good?
Yeah. What was the biggest takeaway you had? What was the entire story trying to say?
I have three things to... I think that he's trying to give as a message. First and probably most important is power can both corrupt and redeem. It is not there's more to say. It's pretty obvious, like the whole idea of like power, power can corrupt. Duh. But this is a good one of power can both corrupt an individual and it can also redeem an individual. Specifically with Felicin. Felicin using her innate power of sexuality, you see how that, can corrupt and ultimately destroy her soul. But there seems to be somewhat of a upward hopeful path of her kind of going through this tragedy and ultimately becoming the Shaik. In many ways could be seen as more tragic than it is, but it seems to be a bit more hopeful, a bit more of like she now has the power to, do something greater. You have the same thing with Coltane. Power is not everything, but he is able to redeem himself, redeem the army, surpass the odds with his pure might and will. Same thing with basically all these other characters. So we have power, corruption, or redemption. You have, also Mappo and Ikarium. Redemption or corruption. So mm-hmm. Mappo being, or Ikarium, all of his power, it ultimately leads to ruin. So then lastly is the idea of war, loyalty, strategy, and tragedy. Everything with Coltane and the armies, great examples. Then history, story, and legacy. Basically, Diker, the Whirlwind, and Coltane, because you see over distance and time, like, how is the story of the Chain of Dogs going to change? How is Coltane's legacy going to endure? We don't know. Diker was supposed to be able to tell the story, but ultimately hasn't. The Whirlwind... the legacy of this history, what does it mean? And it's been passed down. How much of the Whirlwind was not in its magic, but in its prophecy and legacy and story brought down that once people were told and were given a sign that the Whirlwind has started, they felt like they had the power to overthrow the Malazan army. Mm-hmm. And that's the power of story. So, those are the things I was thinking about when reading this book.
Nice.
What about you?
I think the big one I got was history of just the how Diker is the historian and how important history is of what is the actual real story of the Malazan world and Ikarium, who doesn't know his own past, what's his own history. And I was reading up some of the quotes from the book of the lesson of history is that no one learns. Right. And even that quote you used about children are dying. Hey, children are dying, Lil nodded. That's a succinct summary of humankind, I'd say. Who needs tomes and volumes of history? Children are dying. The injustices of the world hide in those three worlds. Just that searing in that idea of how important history is, what is the actual true story we're getting as we continue to read Malazan, the Chain of Dogs that we just saw, and every event that we know the real history of it, how much will that be obfuscated? I said that close to correctly.
Close.
Obfuscated. Yeah.
Obfuscated.
Yeah, it's right. And that whole point of we're watching the history now and what is the just the importance of history in general. Yeah.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, I think it was good overall. I think I think it's maybe over time I'll think more or less of it, but I'm not. I think it's got the thematic elements there. I guess this has more theme than it does message. So it has the subjects, the themes of power corrupts and the redemption and all those things that you've seen in other books. I think the message of Molazin will be more clear as we get to the end, because there is the...
Unironically, I think it's the power of friendship.
Yeah, the connections you make. It's, hey, who do you know? That's what we learned. The power of friendship keeps the Molazin Seventh Army. They would have lived.
Yeah, they would have lived. If they just were only had friends. More friends.
Wow. Anything else you want to say on themes and about the book in general?
Well, I think this is it does a great job of showing the loyalty and the mentality behind soldiers at war in a more hopeful light, especially. There's often very grim depictions of soldiers, which, duh, obviously. Mm-hmm. But in this, it is nice to see the camaraderie of these soldiers and very much how funny a lot of them are, which in my experience is very true. Like, some of the funniest people you're going to find is soldiers, and very much they're funny in very grim situations, like the Malazan army is. So yeah, that's stuff I really enjoyed and loved thinking about.
Let us know what you thought on Deadhouse Gates, book 2 of Molazin.
We will be reading book 3.
Memories of Ice.
We're both convinced, so we'll be reading that sooner than it took for us to read book 2.
Which was like 5 years, so.
Yeah,
Less than 5 years.
Less than 5 years.
And let us know what you thought of Deadhouse Gates, and where does this even rank in Molazin? Because I've heard some people's favorites is Deadhouse Gate, but also that it gets much better.
I hear Memories of Ice is consistently
one of the top.
Got it. Well, we're in for a good one.
We'll see you next episode. Bye, everybody.
Bye, all.